Hi, I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 166 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. We've had several guests recently who are super collaborators, and Nora O'Connor, this week's guest, is as good as they get. She released her third solo album, My Heart, in 2022, her first in 18 years. And it was a reminder of what a smart, insightful, tuneful songwriter she is. It also, of course, showcases her wonderful voice. I'm grateful that O'Connor makes time for her own music, given how much work she does with other people. Over the past couple of months, you could see and hear her singing the songs of the Roaches with Kelly Hogan and Seema Cunningham, who also have been Caro Pop guests, performing in 8 Andrew Bird Gazella Guide concerts at Chicago's 4th Presbyterian Church, co-starring in a New Year's Eve show featuring songs from 1974 with the ultra-talented country-ish singer-songwriter Robbie Foulkes, another previous Caro Pop guest, and playing with her band The Flat Five, with whom she's currently doing a Wednesday night residency at Chicago's revered Hideout Club. Coming later this year, a tour with Nico Case, on whose upcoming album O'Connor sings and plays, as she has done with Case for many years. O'Connor also has performed with the Decemberists, the New Pornographers, Iron and Wine, Mavis Staples, and many others. These artists love her because she can sing harmonies like nobody's business, and she's a pro's pro.
You're not alone.
On many gigs, she harmonizes with Kelly Hogan, a Flat Five bandmate with whom she creates a kind of singing alchemy.
Isn't it a crying shame? No one even knows your silly name. We all love you just the same. The night is yours. This is your night.
Nora and I spoke at the dining room table of her Evanston, Illinois home, with a piano, guitars, and her husband's wall of records nearby. This is where she writes and makes music, and she tells of how she does it. She also talks about the music she grew up listening to on Chicago's South Side, including Rush and Styx, and how she moved into country territory with her early band, The Blacks, and her 2004 solo album, Till the Dawn. Then there's the obscure 60s pop that the Flat Five treasures and the way such songcraft is apparent on My Heart. O'Connor also discusses what she has learned from performing with so many other artists, what the effects of sobriety have been, how she has balanced her career and family life, and whether she thinks a male performer would have faced similar challenges, and how she regards being what she calls a music worker. What kind of ambitions does she have for herself or the Flat Five? Or is the relaxed vibe of the Flat Five the main point? And how important has the Hideout been to her musical development, especially given how many of her friends and colleagues, such as Hogan, Nico Case, Andrew Bird, and the Hanson family, have worked and played there? No surprise, O'Connor is a down-to-earth conversationalist who draws you in to listen, just as she does when she's on stage. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Nora O'Connor. Hi, Nora.
Hi, Mark.
Thank you for having me in your home and your lair. And for those of you who are listening, which is everyone, there's a piano off to the over your sort of right shoulder and sort of a music room, living room, a lot of records to the left. Where do you play music in this house?
Right where I'm sitting right now at the dining room table a lot. I end up sitting here. I have an office right behind you where I have a desk and I have my guitars and my amps. When I'm recording and writing, I'm usually in that room. And but when I'm practicing for any number of shows I have coming up, I'm usually sitting at the dining room table.
With a guitar usually?
With a guitar,
yeah. Although sometimes bass, because sometimes you're playing bass in bass,
yeah,
too.
Yeah. Bass is usually, and there's a little music room behind you. I usually play in there.
Do you have any kind of routine, or do you just play when you can play?
I really don't. I feel like my schedule is so wavy where I'm like December. I probably had 20 gigs in December.
Yeah.
And now here we are in January, and there's some like crickets happening. So like this is the time when I have to find like the structure to sit down and write or sit down and work on things that are just for me, because I spent a lot of time learning songs for other people because I'm in a lot of other bands.
Right.
So it really depends.
Yeah, you described this as crickety, but you played two nights ago at the Hideout, and then you're playing again next Wednesday and the Wednesday afterwards.
Yeah.
So that's 3 in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Is that just because you only have those flat five shows and you don't have other shows lined up for January?
I have. February? I've got some other stuff coming up, but it's kind of just now getting, like with these flat five, the Hideout residency we did Wednesday night, and Chris Legan was our guest and we sang all Chris Legan songs. So I kind of knew them all. I kind of, right. it was
the two albums are all Chris Legan songs.
The two albums are. Yeah. And next week we'll have, a young artist by the name of Andrew Saw, which I'm sure you're familiar.
I've seen Andrew Saw,
the big
cowboy hat, and
yeah. He's a wonderful singer and just a great person. And he's coming, and he's planning a show where he's doing all Dionne Warwick songs.
Oh wow!
So I'm not sure if we're backing him up, but that's my work this week, is to work on songs for the next flat five show.
So will there be a flat five set and an Andrew Saw set?
Or yeah, really our guests are just playing a handful of songs in the middle of our set. So it's not like we have an opener. We're just kind of, it's a flat five show. And then we're introducing, you know, we had Chris Legan come up in the middle of the set. We'll have Andrew come up in the middle. And then the last week will be with our friend, Paul Sebar, who's going to come, and we'll probably even learn a couple of his songs.
So you got to learn songs for all of that. I mean, so you made reference to December. It did seem like in December, toward the end of the year, you were doing about 500 shows or something like that. So you had Andrew Bird, mm-hmm. you had the Roaches.
Yeah.
What else? You had another flat five.
A flat five show.
Your Fitzgeralds, I think.
The Roaches. And what else was there?
I remember there was, I mean, more, was because I remember thinking
Andrew Bird shows in the middle of the, in the beginning of the month, which felt like, you know, felt like I had a little day job. I was driving downtown to the Mag Mile every day for a week and doing these shows with him. Yeah, it was fun.
Is there a lot of rehearsal on those, or at this point, do you sort of know what you're?
There's not. I love singing with Andrew because I'm just always on my toes. Like, I'm not exactly sure what he's going to do vocally. So I'm just like split second kind of deciding where my harmony's going to go. And I've sung with him for a very long time. So I've gotten pretty, pretty good at determining where to go. So it's a really fun game for me to play. But he sent me, you know, he sent me a set list a month in advance. So I had time to work on stuff.
So he sent you the songs so you could work on the songs at least.
Yeah, for sure.
How long have you known him? I mean, he was on your second solo album, which was...
So Andrew, 2006. I guess it's like back in 1997, the Blacks opened up for the Bowl of Fire at Shubas. And that's when I met Andrew for the first time. And we just kind of hit it off. He was curious what it would be like for the two of us to sing together. And then I sang on The Swimming Hour, which came out in 98, maybe, or 99. And I ended up touring with him for about 5 years with the Bowl of Fire. And then I toured with him as a trio with Kevin O'Donnell, and as a duo, we drove around Europe with our printouts of MapQuest directions that were terrible. And so a long, long time since the late 1900s.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, cause I know he's on, Till the Dawn from 2004. He's playing on that as well. How much of what you're doing now is you thinking, oh, I want to do this show, or people calling you and say, hey, I need you, or would love to have you on these dates?
I think for the past few years, it's been pretty consistent, where I jumped on a Nico tour in 2021 as kind of a fill-in. I mean, I've sang with her on and off for, you know, 20 years. She would have me come sing on a record, or have me come fly to New York and do one of the TV shows when she wanted to do one of the late night shows when she wanted like a nice big fat band. And so I said yes to her, and you know, I came with my guitar and my bass, not really sure what I'd be playing. And when we got in rehearsal, I had the bass guitar on, and I played bass on one song. And then they were just, it was Carl Newman and Zach Janakian, who's a multi-instrumentalist from Woodstock, and Nico and myself. And I just kind of stayed on bass. And then for the next 3 years, I played bass for her.
But you went in not knowing if you're going to do bass or guitar.
I went in not knowing, and then I was, and suddenly I'm a bass player, and I do play bass. You know,
I've seen you play bass.
I've played, it's not my primary instrument, but I really enjoy it. I love playing bass. I think any guitar player will tell you they love playing bass.
If someone just randomly asked you to play in a band for some shows, would you rather play guitar or bass?
I think it depends. I really love playing rhythm guitar too. I mean, that's where I'm most comfortable. So that's probably where I would, like, if someone asked me, if somebody, and not many people need a acoustic rhythm guitar player in their band, but I'm up for it.
Is it easier to sing when you're playing rhythm guitar than?
Yes. Oh my God. Yes. It took a minute to learn how to sing harmonies and play bass at the same time.
So are you still doing Nico Kay stuff? I know she's got her book out because she's coming here, I think next week or 2 weeks.
I've been on every tour she's done, and she's got a record coming out in September. And I think I'm going to come. It's going to be a different band that she's bringing out. And I think I'm going to come play some auxiliary guitar and do some singing for her.
Not bass.
Not bass.
Are you on the record?
Yeah, I'm on the new record. Yeah.
How's the record?
It's great. It's weird. It's Nico. You know, it's like her process of writing songs is really fascinating. She's always stretching. She's always reaching and looking for a new way to sing and be and write, I think. Not be, but write.
She's looking for a new way to write.
Yeah. I mean, she's.
And how often are you writing? Like, do you write just whenever, or do you write when you have a project?
I feel like I write in like clusters. Like, I don't get up in the morning and have a writing ritual.
Right.
And I think when writing hits me, it hits me where I'm just suddenly like kind of open to observation, and I'm not always open to observation of conversations or people or like little like cool sentences that I think can be a story and then form into a song. So it kind of comes and goes. I'm writing right now for whatever a fourth record might look like for me, but it's slow coming. But I think once I'm open, then the writing kind of comes a little bit quicker.
So
and then it goes away.
when you say you're writing for fourth record, do you sort of have a concept for that record, or is it more you're writing songs and when you have enough songs, that'll make a record?
So I did a record a couple years ago, and I hadn't done a record since 2004 or wherever it was. So I think just building on from this last record, just kind of building on that, but pushing myself a little more, maybe production wise, pushing the envelope a little bit, trying to find different kinds of sounds or instrumentation or ways to sing or build harmonies.
That's interesting. So My Heart came out in 2022, Until the Dawn was 2004. So you had 18 years in between. So was this an album where, like, you know, one of those songs was from 2009 and one was from 2012? Or was it really like, hey, it's the pandemic, I feel like writing an album, boom?
It was that. I wrote them all in between 2020 and 2020. Too. But it was a lot of things. Like, I don't talk about it a lot, but I got sober in 2020. And I think that really, really opened a spigot of a lot of feelings. And I was trying to figure out where to put them. Mm. And it made sense with a little bit of time on my hands, and looking for just an outlet. They just kind of came rolling out for that record.
Did you feel like, I don't want to dig too much into your personal life, but in terms of going sober, did that change your creativity?
It did. Yeah, it really did. I mean, for me, like alcohol or pot was kind of a way to make, although I never for many, many years, I wasn't getting drunk and playing shows. Like I stopped doing that a long time ago because this is my career and it's job and I show up for the job. But I feel like kind of taking away substances made things feel a little more raw, and I had to kind of, you know, work through old junk, and I was able to do that, and I'm still doing that. It was just different. I'm different now. Mm. I'm just a different person.
Yeah. When you write songs, like For My Heart or this fourth record that's coming up, do you see yourself as a storyteller, or are you sort of digging into your own feelings, or sort of figuring out a way to kind of do both?
I'm figuring out a way how to do both, because my go-to is just kind of write from experience and then like twist a little tale into that. Like it's not, it's personal and it's not. Based on true events, kind of storytelling or songwriting, but I really do kind of tend to write about relationships and heartbreak and loss and love. Like those themes come up over and over again. I was experimenting a little more with short little stories in my last record, and I do want to do that more. My go-to is to write a love song or a breakup song.
Right.
But I'm trying to kind of expand and be a little more of a, I don't want to say a storyteller, but just come up with like really kind of, it's so great when you can hear a song and you can just picture like, I light the fire and while you put the garden in the vase that you bought, you know, like just really specific images. So more imagery in songs interests me.
Right. And musically, like I sort of associated you, especially when I would like see you with the Flat Five, you would sort of pull out the obscure 60s pop sunshiny cover that I was like, oh my God, I can't believe they know the song. And you would usually be the one singing it. So I sort of felt bonded through this, you know, 60s geekery thing. Yet your background is much more like going back a while. There's a lot more country in there. So have you sort of shifted in your taste? And when you were like growing up, what were the first records that got you excited? I guess those are two totally different questions, but we're just rolling with it.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in the 70s and I'm the youngest of four. So I listened to whatever music my siblings brought home. And it was, you know, a lot of Rush and Zeppelin and Yes and Styx and REO Speedwagon and, you know, Elton John. And so it's like classic rock was a big, was my beginnings. And then
did you love that, or were you just exposed to it?
I loved Rush. I love Rush. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can air drum all sorts of Rush all day for you, which you can't really see on this podcast, but maybe some other time. As I was kind of developing my own taste and buying my own records, and in high school, I started getting into, definitely like Heart and Joni Mitchell, and then it was like Kate Bush, Eurythmics, like Annie Lennox. When I first saw the Sweet Dreams video, I was like, ooh, this is scary. Who is this lady with this short haircut? You know, it was, so I was really into all that, you know, the first batch of Eurythmics records that came out, and Kate Bush really blew my mind. And
she definitely seemed totally otherworldly at the time.
She was. Yeah, she was. Like, she was who I would, you know, sing in the mirror to a lip sync in the mirror with a hand brush. It was just so like theatrical, and her vocal range was just so amazing. Not that I thought I could do it, but I liked pretending to be Kate Bush when I was in high school.
Do you remember the first song you wrote?
The first song I wrote, was in college. I was in a band called the Immigrant Fleas. Yikes.
Fleas, F-L-E-A-S or F-L-E-E-S? Because it could be...
F-L-E-A-S, I don't know.
Immigrant Fleas, because it could be a sentence too. But.
Yeah. So funny, band names. Some are very cringeworthy. But, you know, we did a lot of Beatles songs and Crosby, Stills, and Nash & Young songs. We did a lot of Harmony songs, like America songs. And that's when I started playing guitar and... I wrote this song called Find Time, like Find Time for Me, kind of a vibe. And yeah, that was the first one.
So was it you need to find time for me?
I need to find time for me.
Oh, okay.
Me, Nora, right. Nora, you guys need to get the hell out of here. It's my turn.
So was it kind of...
I wasn't very good at picking boyfriends back then, so...
Was it kind of a folky song or was it country?
It was kind of poppy, like acoustic pop, I'd say it was. It was kind of jumpy and poppy, yeah.
So when did you veer from all the stuff into the country stuff?
Well, I think once I... got an acoustic guitar. I mean, I grew up listening to Irish music too. My parents are from Ireland and we had the Irish Hour blasting in the house. And
you grew up on the South Side, by the way?
I did, yeah. Okay. Southwest Side. And I, they had a lot of parties and at the end of the parties, people would just sing. Like it didn't matter if you can sing or not, like no inhibitions, just everyone would sing a song. So I kind of had those like kind of Irish folk sensibilities. And it's kind of in my DNA. But then I went to college. When I went to college and picked up a guitar for the first time, I went to college in Southern Illinois. I like met all like the bluegrass people down in Southern Illinois, and I kind of would sit in bluegrass jams, and they would teach me, and like were so kind to let me just kind of strum along and try to catch up or try to catch on, And that felt really good. It felt natural to play that kind of music and my voice felt nice singing those kinds of songs. So
did you have dreams of, you know, being a professional musician at that point or being a star? And was it sort of like, I want to be Nora O'Connor solo star, or I want to be like in a band? Like what were you thinking back then?
I always wanted to be in the band. I mean, back then, and then when I moved up to Chicago in the mid 90s, there were still record companies in the suburbs. There was still like Warner Brothers and WEA. And I had friends who worked at record companies. Like there was still like getting signed to a record label was like a goal. But I don't know that it was for me. I don't know that I ever thought I was good enough to actually get signed and have a label. But once I found my way to the Hideout in the late 90s, there was just like this magic of networking with other musicians and then like singing in each other's bands and then kind of finding my way into the Bowl of Fire or into the Blacks. Or actually before that, I was in a band called Urban Twang. Yeah. That was really fun. Max and Trish, who I mean, they still play shows, but they were really good to me. Like they kind of taught me how to play mandolin. So I played mandolin on a few songs and, you know, and then I met Danny and Gina Black, and I quit Urban Twang and just started working with the Blacks then.
Right. And that was what, Insurgent Country or?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's what they call it.
Some label like that. Yeah, I think that was how it
was. Punk, was that a thing?
Right.
Yeah.
Back when Bloodshot was all about the Insurgent Country.
Right, yeah, we were definitely that.
So did you come to the country part of it naturally, or was it just sort of like, this is what they were playing, so you sort of shifted into that mode?
I think I came to it naturally, like just... You know, when I was in college learning how to play guitar, I was just playing a lot of bluegrass and like just learning every like Nancy Griffith song I can learn. So I don't know like how much like urban twang influenced my way. It was just something. It was just like something that I it was just a band that I was in for a little while.
Right. And I one of my questions I wrote up ahead of time was just how important has the Hideout been in your musical life?
I mean, very. I mean, it was formative. I mean, back in, I think it was 97, like just not long after they opened, when, you know, the Blacks, we had our picture taken with one of the first bands with our picture taken with the fish behind us.
Nice.
And, you know, and it was just a place back then where, and I know that there's bars that are that now for younger bands, but, you know, Hogan was working behind.
I was wondering if that's where you met her.
Nico worked there for a little bit, and, you know, and Andrew Bird and the Hanson family, and, you know, and then like John Langford and Sally, and, you know, we were all like on tour or about to go on tour or coming home from tour, like just kind of this flow of different musicians. And we would all go to each other's shows and play shows together at the Hideout. And, yeah, like I found my people.
And what was it about the Hideout that made it, you know, the magnet for you guys?
I don't know. I mean, it was, to me, it was like the perfect size place, like not too big, and actually nice and small. I don't know what it was. I think, maybe, you know, because we were all like, a lot of us were on Bloodshot Records. It was just like a place we grabbed onto. And then Tim and Katie were like, come, like, you know, they were, super supportive of, you know, they were our peers, you know? So it was like, we're playing at our friends' place.
Right.
We were just friends.
And still, I mean, you're doing a residency there now.
Yeah.
You did one there in 2014, I think. And you did the Buckingham Nicks show album all the way through.
Yeah.
So it's a place you could just kind of go do stuff like that.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And like when you kind of do a residency like that, like with the Flat Five, or when I was doing, it's an opportunity to kind of build your material, get more material together, some accountability. Like I have to, you know, I've got this week to do, learn these amount of songs. And, you know, so it's, you know, kind of stretching your muscles and expanding your repertoire.
And the people it attracts, you're going to have a good audience that's going to be receptive to you doing something new or doing something, whatever the hell you want to do. Like, like there, I'm sure that there are many bars where, you know, you could go up there and people would just be like, you know, I'm indifferent to this. I don't know this song. And the Hideout, it's always like, oh, great. What's Nora doing this week?
It felt good there. I mean, I've bombed in many places. Like I remember playing a solo show in like 2000. Maybe it was like 99 or 2000 at the Abbey Pub opening up for Rhett Miller. And I was just like devoured by his fans. Like they were just so loud and like talking. And
Boo, Rhett Miller fans. That's not right.
And I've played with him many times since then. But, you know, maybe it just wasn't a matchup. And I was pretty green still, kind of playing. I hadn't played a lot of solo shows. And so I ended up cutting my set short that night. But the Hideout, like I feel like the Hideout is a listening room, and people come, will listen to music, except for the people in the back. But
right. And the fact that there's another room where you can go talk and there's a door between them. So that's helpful.
Yeah.
Is that where you met Kelly Hogan and Nico, or did you guys all just end up working there at the same time?
Kelly Hogan and I met, she was working for Bloodshot as a publicist when she moved here, and it was her and Rob Miller that came and met me and Danny and Gina and Jimmy, like for a beer before the Blacks got signed, formerly the Black Family got signed to Bloodshot. I don't remember meeting her that day, but she has got a memory. She's got a really good memory. And then we ended up singing together on Swing Hour by Andrew Bird.
Right.
And somehow, and we were just like, whoa, this is, we loved singing together right away. Like my voice went here, her voice went here. We both kind of each naturally kind of go to different places. Sometimes we land on the same place, but like we, you know, at this point we can read each other's minds.
Yeah, no, there's something about these like sort of telepathic relationships among singers where you two, you know, you have like the harmonies and the melodies and it's sort of intertwining in unpredictable ways, but it's like the third voice, like the two of you, there's each of you and then there's the two of you together. Mm. And, you know, a lot of times that happens when you're dealing with siblings like the Roaches, but then you have these kind of virtual siblings like you guys. Like, how does that happen? Explain it.
It's a good question. Well, I think we're both, you know, total harmony junkies. Like we both have always naturally gone to the harmony or the harmony that's not there and made up a harmony. Like we both do that when we listen to music. Like that's, you know, that's what we hear. So that's what we love. And I learned a lot from Kelly singing harmony. I feel like I used to be sort of a bull in a china shop when I'm singing with other people. Like it's taken me, I'm better at it now, but it took me a long time to, you know, realize, as Kelly says, or somebody said to her, that, you know, harmony is 90% listening and 10% singing. And if you don't hear the other people singing with you, you're singing too loud, you know? So, you know, I've been able to kind of finesse that over the years. And, you know, we've been singing together for over 20 years. So we've just gotten really, really good at it. And I like the way our voices rub together. Yeah, it's a magical thing, I think.
When you two
I think it's magic.
When you two are, I think it is too, the alchemy of your voices. When you sing together or you're deciding to sing a song, do you sort of fight over who gets to do the harmony? And, you know, like a lot of times people want to do the melody, but I imagine each of you wanted to do the harmony.
Well, I feel like Kelly and I have, when we work together, we're like, we do the lady parts, as we like to say, or in, you know, like for the Decemberists, we sang right. backup for the Decemberists for a bunch of years. And she kind of naturally goes high. I naturally go low. And when we hit the same note, we both jump off right away because we're both really nice. And so we have those experiences too. In the Flat Five, you know, we'll pick a song or someone will bring a song and decide, okay, who's going to sing lead? Who's going to sing the harmony? So there's negotiating
right.
in that band.
That was my next question. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, Kelly and I, when we're singing together, we're not singing the melody. We're singing the harmony parts.
In general, like if you're like in backing a band, like yeah. you know, Decemberists or yeah. Mavis or
yeah.
whoever else you're.
Yeah. You're or like with. When we sang with Andrew Bird, when we sang harmonies on the Swimming Hour, like that was kind of our first experience into, you know, doing the lady parts. And we've done it a lot since.
Carol Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero, and the premium lager Cold Time. No matter the weather, Cold Time hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip.
My baby shakes like Tina Turner's daughter. He runs around the house in just a little top. On his behind, you can set a glass of water. He hurly gullies and don't ever trip a drop.
What's sort of the origin story of the Flat Five, just for those who don't know?
So the Flat Five kind of started, it kind of was built on Scott Legan moved to Chicago and he and Kelly got together and started singing together. And then they brought me in, Kelly, Scott, and Nora, for a little band that we call the Lamentations, which was like kind of a spiritual band, but we tried to find songs that didn't talk about Jesus. So our set list was really short. And we got a gig opening up for the Blind Boys of Alabama. And so the trio started, and then we brought in Casey, and then we brought in Gerald Dowd to play drums, and he played drums. And back then we were playing, you know, one show a year because everybody was doing a lot of different things, and it hasn't changed too much. And then eventually we brought in Alex Hall. He was working a lot with Scott and Casey and the Western Elstons and some other bands. So that was, trying to think when our first show was, maybe 2003 or four. So, you know, we've been doing it for about 20 years.
So what was the concept when you started? Was it just to do these kind of fun, obscure covers?
Yeah, it was. And it was definitely trying to keep the set list with songs that are kind of like up with people, like not, you know, we all love to sing the downer tunes, but with the Flat Five, we try to keep it positive, and we do keep it positive. We don't really have any, you know, breakup songs or heartbreak songs. We do sing Don't Go Breaking My Heart by Burt Bacharach. So that, and really like Kelly and Scott, I mean, we all bring songs to the table, but, you know, Scott is really good. Kelly is really good at finding like weird, obscure, like, you know, Free Design songs or Wendy and Bonnie, or we have a friend, Mike Billington, who every once in a while will send us a song like, hey, the Flat Five should do it. And he's usually always right. And we'll do it. Like he turned us on to Wendy and Bonnie and a couple other things. So, yeah, we're trying to turn people on to other music. You know, we're really trying to find obscure, cool, vintage songs.
Right. I mean, the Flat Five, like seeing you guys live is just like, that's like the thing, I think, you know, just in terms of, because you hear the harmonies and just all, like all of you sound so great together. And then you're just pulling these songs out of nowhere. You're like, what? And occasionally I'll recognize one and feel, you know, my nerdiness has been vindicated. And then you've recorded two albums, and those are all songs by Scott's brother, Chris Legan. So it's kind of I mean, obviously you play those songs in concert too, but it's kind of a different thing. Did you always sort of think that like the studio version of Flat Five is a slightly different concept than the live version?
I think so. You know, I mean, it was only 2016 that we made that first record. So we went, you know, 15 years without making a record. It just like, we didn't really want to go in and record the songs we do live, like record an album of covers. And we certainly weren't writing music together as much music as we were learning together. It wasn't every once in a while we would do one of our original songs, but we started, you know, we started to kind of collect Chris Legan songs into our set. And, you know, Chris doesn't play out a lot, and we just really wanted to turn people on to Chris Legan and showcase his songs. And it just was a match made in heaven, the Flat Five and Chris Legan songs. So it worked out really well. So we ended up making two records.
So like if there's a third or what, however many other Flat Five records, are they Chris Legan records, or is there going to be a different concept?
We might be done with that, but Chris, he just made another album. I mean, Chris is making an album a year at this point. So who knows? But we have talked about working with other songwriters and for a possible third album.
And you guys all write songs too.
We do.
So you could do like a Flat Five originals record. Is that just too daunting?
I think so. Yeah, it's hard enough to write songs for ourselves, let alone writing songs for a band. But you never know. You
kind of like that the Rock Pile record where you guys all play on each other's records and then finally have to do like your own songs on your own record. Like, oh, this one has the Dave Edmonds and the Nick Lowe songs.
I mean, that would be amazing. But with our schedules, I mean, Kelly is constantly out with Mavis Staples, Scott and Casey with NRBQ and other bands. And, you know, and I'm out with the New Pornographers, or I'm out with Nico. So that's what, you know. So our time together is super sacred and special, and we don't want it to be hard and stressful.
Yeah. And it seems like it's also not agenda/ambition driven.
It's not at all.
Where it's like, oh, we can get together whenever we want and do our shows whenever we want, and there's no pressure. And, you know, when the stars are aligned, it's just that much more magical, but there's not that pressure on it.
Yeah, for better or worse, we're all pretty chill about it.
In terms of touring with other people, I mean, you toured with Iron and Wine for a long time. You did the Decemberists. You played with Mavis on, you know, her album, You're Not Alone. You've obviously sung live with her. What have you learned from sort of each of those experiences? Like, what are sort of the formative experiences of going out and seeing how other bands and acts and musicians operate?
I've toured with a lot of great bands. I mean, what I like about it is the hyper focused of you're just doing your job. Like, there's no distractions. There's no dishes to be done. There's no, but what I've learned from them, it's just really great to watch, like the machine at that level, you know, at like Decemberist level. I mean, it was astounding, like the way that operation ran, and to Iron and Wine, to Nico Case, to New Pornographers. Like, it's all different levels and kind of different ways of doing it and trying to figure out like just how to keep moving forward, because I mean, you have to go on the road if you want to make money, you know. Right. There's just not a lot of record sales, and but at the same time, there kind of are for some of these older bands, because older people buy music. Like, we're still buying albums and still going to shows. There's still like a lot of patrons in our demographic, you know. So as long as we're alive and our fans are alive, we can keep doing this. But I don't know how else to answer that question. I mean, for me, it's the variety is really nice. Like, it's nice to just go on tour and show up as a support person. Like, I'm good at that. It's, you know, it's lower pressure than playing solo and doing all your own promo and press and all that stuff. And then after a while, you know, I'll feel the need to, like, I need to write a song or I need to sing my own song. So I'm going to write some songs. I'm going to book some solo shows so I can just scratch all these different itches that I have musically. Like, I just love, you know, I love standing, you know, left and back a little bit. And then sometimes I need to stand in the center and use my voice. So I like the variety of ways that I have kind of sewn together a career here.
I remember several years ago, Mary, my wife, was down for the Innings Festival in the Phoenix area.
That's right.
And we ran into you and Kelly and Chris, and I think it was before you went on with the Decemberists.
Yeah,
for that.
Yeah.
So like doing a big festival and whatever, I mean, they were obviously on tour at that point. Is just the mechanics of that just on such a different scale from what you normally are doing in your musical life?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I go from that to, you know, playing in somebody's basement and just hanging out with everybody who's at the show. Like, it's quite a contrast. And I like them both. I like being able to, I mean, I'm kind of an introvert. I'm kind of shy. So sometimes being in a room full of 30 people or playing in someone's basement can really like completely drain me. And by the time it's over, I'm empty and I have to go to bed. And, you know, where if I'm on tour with a Decemberist, I have some time and some space and some privacy, you know, and I don't see it that way. It's just I feel like I'm a music worker and I'm just showing up and doing my job. So I don't think a lot about like the success or the bells and whistles of it. I just feel like I'm working.
I'm assuming that the vibe with, and again, I'm just throwing names out there, Iron and Wine or Nico Case or the Decemberists, I would think that each would have its own dynamic. And, you know, I'm wondering if there are there's anything you sort of observed from them, like, oh, you know, this was kind of an interesting way of working that I wasn't really exposed to, or this is like something I'm glad I'm avoiding in the rest of my musical life.
Well, the resources and the, you know, and the food writers are a lot more impressive, and those bigger, I mean, with Iron and Wine, it was, you know, Sam made this record and he really wanted to put a big band together. So there were three singers, three strings, three horns, drums, bass, Rob Berger, with his whole keyboard rig. It was a really big, you know, production. And with the Decemberists, it was two tour buses and a semi with a full set. And, you know, and with Nico, it's the, you know, it's the five of us, and we have this like wonderful, like kind of small crew, small band. You know, my favorite part of being on tour with her is this time we have on the bus in the morning having coffee. Like it's that time and the show. Those are my two favorite times of the day with Nico. So, I mean, being on tour, it's, I think with all of them, the similarity is you kind of do the same thing every day. You have this schedule, you get up, you've got sound check, you have dinner, you have that quiet time between dinner and showtime where you're like, what the hell am I doing with my life? What's going on? You know, because you don't know, I don't know, you're trying to reserve energy, and there's a lot of time to kind of contemplate. It's I think it's a weird time of day for a lot of musicians, the post soundcheck pre-show time. So they're all kind of the same in that way, you know, and like joining the Decemberists, you know, they've been a band for a long time. So, you know, I think not that anyone was making us feel like outsiders, but we were, you know, Kelly and I were kind of like outside of this, you know, family. It took a minute to kind of, you know, penetrate and be comfortable within the band. It didn't take long because they're wonderful, you know, people, but it was a little intimidating walking into that family, you know?
Right. And speaking of families, I mean, obviously you have your own family. And so, you know, being a working musician, as with any job, you're balancing, you know, family obligations with the professional obligations. I mean, your kids have been getting older. Like, how have you just overall sort of navigated that and just like what's been the balance there?
I don't know that there is such thing as balance for me and for this job and for our family, but I mean, I didn't take a lot of tours. I remember, you know, and Kelly Hogan brought me on to a few of them. Like the first tour I did after having kids was this, did a year with Jacob Dylan where Kelly and I sang backup for him. And then the Iron and Wine thing came up, and I was doing kind of like spot shows with Nico or jumping in when they would come through town. So, and then the Iron Wine thing happened, and then the Decemberist thing happened, and then I started doing some tours with Nico Case and the New Pornographers. So they kind of have come in spurts, and you know, we just do it. You know, we just do it. Chris, my husband's a high school teacher. You know, we've gotten a little bit of help where we need it, or he would adjust his schedule where he's coming home before the kids get out of school, and or I would do like summer tours when he's home, and I would come home from tour and find out, you know, we don't do it like that anymore. I would come home, try to be the best mom I could. Like, yeah, we don't do it like that anymore. I'm like, okay. but I don't, you know, I don't know that I've toured as much as men in bands, but, I don't know. We've managed to figure it out. So I have, and I think that has kept me working as much as I do, that I have found ways to go on these tours. And it's been hard, like being away from my kids is hard, especially when I'm getting into like the fourth week of a tour, like that's right. That's a lot. And that gets really difficult. But then I come home and I'm home and I'm, you know, playing shows at home, but I'm up, you know, I'm having dinner with my family every night. I mean, some people never have dinner with their kids because they're working, or some people are gone before their kids get up. So there's a different way to do life and family and work. And this is just happens to be like how we've done it. And now that my kids are older, it's actually been a little bit harder because I know my one is away at college now, but before he went away to college, like I knew my days were numbered with them. And right. So I didn't want to be, I thought it would be easier as they got older, but it doesn't, because they're, you know, he's not home every day anymore. And that's like our new reality. And it's also great that I don't have to, you know, I've got one less fish to fry. That's kind of nice.
Right.
But, I miss you, James, but, yeah, so we figured it out. We figured it out and it works for us.
Did you earlier in your career have sort of any sort of set of ambitions or goals, and did those shift over the years?
They have. I think it took me a while to figure out like where I wanted to land. And I just feel like I've kind of found it. Like I like playing solo, and I like being an auxiliary member of, I feel like I have a lot to offer as an auxiliary member. I can play different instruments. I can, you know, I love to sing harmony. It's my favorite thing to do. So, you know, I feel like I've pitched myself as a, you know, multi-singer, multi-instrumentalist a lot. So, I'm surprised it turned out that way. Like I didn't know I was going to be a music worker. I didn't really see that coming, and I didn't know I was allowed to. I didn't know I could do that. And it's just kind of how it's worked out for me.
Is there anything that you would call your happy place in music? Is it on stage with the Flat Five, or is it recording something, or?
It's all of those things. I think singing with the Flat Five is one of my favorite things, because I feel like I'm in a band, but I'm also like, I'm watching my favorite band at the same time. Mm. I'm in a band, like standing next to Casey McDonough playing bass. I mean, he is just unbelievably talented and what my favorite bass player. And then there's Kelly Hogan and Scott Legan, forget about it. And Alex Hall on drums, you know, that is definitely my happy place. I mean, being on stage in general, I feel like that is like, it's church for me. It's where I feel like I'm in my body. I'm in the moment. And so that it's like a spiritual experience, I think, for me.
And you've talked about Flat Five being kind of like low pressure, relaxing. Has there ever been a push from anyone in the band to say, hey, let's take this to the next level. Let's get signed and do a big record and try to get on tour and become more nationally known, and, you know, see everyone could, the world could see how wonderful we are.
Yeah, no, no, because we all tour with different bands, that the Flat Five is our passion project for, and we've done a tiny bit of touring. I mean, never say never. Like who knows what's going to happen. I don't even want to talk about when my bandmates aren't touring with who they're touring right now. I don't even want to talk about that or think about that. But there might be a time when we have more time to, like in 2016, we have more time to devote to the band. So we made a record. We did some regional things. We did a West Coast tour. And actually that was great. Playing every day with the Flat Five, playing every day on tour is just an amazing, feeling. Like you discover new things every day. You feel like you're getting better, and there's just this like discipline that happens. And so I just, when I can play every day with a band or even doing my own thing, there's just this feeling of advancement, of just like getting better. And I'm still like, I'm 56 years old. I feel like I'm still discovering parts of my voice that I didn't know were there. Like, I'm just glad I can still sing.
Right. And then there was the Roaches. You guys just did these Roaches shows, and you have another one of those coming up too, I think, in Madison.
Yeah.
So that's
Stop and Opera House and Acorn Theater in Three Oaks, Michigan.
So on top of everything else, how does it happen that you and Sima Cunningham and Kelly decide we're going to be the Roaches for some concerts?
Well, we did it in 2017. Our friend Edith Frost reached out to Kelly, I think Kelly, and said she wanted to do a Roaches tribute show. So we put a band together, Edith, Kelly and I, and hired John Carpenter and Liam Davis. And, you know, Kelly had been just a big fan of Sima and Macy and wanted to bring Sima on. And so we did it in 2017 with a full band, but we wanted to do it again with just the three voices. I was on tour with the New Pornographers and Phenom was opening, and I was jumping on stage with them and singing Runs in the Family every night. And so I just brought it up to Sima. You know, we should either record one of these songs or we should do another show. And it just made sense. Like Sima, Nora, Kelly, like all of our voices automatically land Sima on Maggie,
right?
Me on Suzzy and Kelly on Terry. Like they all naturally kind of land in those places. And there's, you know, there's a lot of complicated harmonies on Roach's songs and weaving in and out. But the bassist was there as far as like, you know, who's basically singing what.
And does doing those shows, I don't know, do you come out of that with any sort of feeling like, oh, I need to, I don't know, write songs with harmonies like this or more songs with harmonies like this or perform more of these Roaches songs in some form or other? Or is it just like, this is just another one of these various things that kind of nourishes you?
That's a good way of putting it. It's something, you know, learning all these songs was really, really hard. You know, I went to Roaches school all this fall, like learning all of these songs and learning all of these harmonies. And we had a bunch of rehearsals. So just that experience of leaving the house, getting together, learning these songs. And we had our first show at Old Town School of Folk Music. And we're just like, we can't just do that once. We have to right. Again, we did a couple songs, a couple shows at the Hideout. And then we're doing, you know, going to the Acorn and the Stoughton Opera House. And, you know, we can't run it into the ground. It's got to be kind of a special thing. But I don't know. We feel like it connected us. It connected us to, you know, a higher power of singing harmonies. And it felt really good. We need to do it, you know, as many times as feels appropriate.
Did you hear from Suzzy or Terry about any of this?
I think so. Yeah. I think Kelly got an email or a text from Suzzy, and she gave us her blessing, which was amazing. And then I think there was like a video clip on one of the socials, and Terry wrote, "Nice job, ladies."
Oh,
yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it was great.
So yeah, you got to do it like a New York show and have them hop on.
Yeah.
You have five Roaches.
I have this crazy story where we were in New York doing David Letterman with Nico Case when Middle Cyclone came out. And our day was, we did David Letterman, and then our friend Lucy Wainwright Roach was opening up for the Indigo Girls at this show, and she invited us. So we went to the show, and, you know, we had tickets at the door, and then they kind of brought us to our table, and Suzzy and Terry and Maggie were sitting at table that we, so I'm like, I just did David Letterman with Nico Case. I'm sitting at a table with the Roaches watching the Indigo Girls. This is fucking nuts. I couldn't believe it. It was like the best day of my life. I must have made, you know, 10 phone calls on my flip phone that night, just crying and telling everybody about what a wonderful day I had. And I'm a really big fan of the Roaches.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Flat Five and the Roaches share an album title.
Another World. That's
there you
right.
go.
That's right. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah, I was going to say, you probably didn't do that consciously, but
not at all. Know. Not at all.
If you call it Keep On Doing, you would have noticed it.
Yeah.
Another World is a little, right. There are other Another Worlds.
Yeah.
Meeting whatever performers you've met, have you ever been starstruck?
Yes. One time I was with Nico. We were playing Bonnaroo, and And at the time, I was just kind of jumping on and off for songs. I wasn't on stage the whole time. So I would jump on and sing a song and jump off. And every time I jumped off, I was standing right next to Bruce Springsteen. He was there with his kids watching side stage. And I kind of had nowhere else to go. So I had to stand next to Bruce Springsteen. I was like, hey, Mr. Springsteen. I was just like, so I was kind of starstruck. And he was like, as lovely, very lovely.
Hey, nice job.
Yeah. Yeah. But I usually, I kind of shy away when there's someone famous in the room. I'm not one to like go up to somebody and talk to them or say hi or ask for a picture or an autograph. I don't do that.
Has there been any time where you've like been performing on stage and you recognize someone in the audience and you're like, oh, geez.
Yeah. I think for an Iron and Wine show, we were playing LA on Halloween and we were dressed as the Muppets and Sam as Jim Henson. And it was just kind of perfect. And there were, you know, 3, 6, 9, 10, 11, 12 people in his band. We were all different.
Which Muppet were you?
I was Miss Piggy. All the singers, we were all Miss Piggy.
Oh, okay.
Nick Offerman and his wife, Megan Mullaney, were in the audience and they came backstage and I was pretty starstruck because they're pretty cool.
Nice. So it sounds like you still have a pretty busy year coming up.
Yeah.
Like what tours are next?
So I'm doing like right now, a couple years ago when the record came out, I did a few a couple of solo living room tours through Undertow.
Right.
Where I drove around the East Coast for a couple weeks and played in people's living rooms. And then I did a Midwest tour and played in people's living rooms or like cool, like just cool alternative spaces, which I really like doing that way. I like showing up at 6, playing at 7, being in my pajamas by 10 o'clock, as opposed to showing up at a club at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and leaving at midnight. So I'm doing small trips out west and to I'm going down to Arkansas and Texas.
Oh, wow.
Columbus. So I'm doing small, quick trips. I don't really have 2 or 3 weeks driving around by myself in me right now. So, and then we're doing stuff with the Flat Five, and then I'm going to, I think, go back on the road with Nico in September when her new album comes out.
Yeah, I was wondering about that too. And in the meantime, are you going to work on your fourth record with all the funky production?
Yeah. Well, not too funky. I'm not that funky, but I do want to elevate it. I loved the experience I had in the studio this last time with Alex Hall, and you know, just try some new keyboard sounds, try some new kind of vocal tricks. So yeah, I'm kind of in writing mode right now and thinking about those ideas, listening to different kinds of music.
Nice. Yeah. Like, not that you need me to say, but like listening to My Heart, I was thinking, oh, you know, like there are a lot, you know, like the vocals are kind of like double tracked on the title track and there's sort of different treatments on stuff. But then so you saying you're going to push that farther makes sense to me because there's definitely a diversity on that, but it's still kind of a piece. And sometimes, you know, yeah, that'd be interesting. That'd be fun.
I like the idea of doubling the lead vocal and, you know, with like a little slap back kind of thing, but not, I want to play around with that kind of
thing. Do you know where you're going to record it?
I'll probably record with Alex Hall again. He's really great to work with. I like his studio a lot.
Where do you record?
He's got a studio called Reliable Recorders in Logan Square. And he's got a lot of just great vintage mics and I like his sensibility and, I feel safe and comfortable. And I, you know, I can do a lot of stuff at home and kind of a little bit of home recording mixed with studio stuff.
And did you record a couple of the songs at Steve's place or did he just kind of come in and work on
them? I did actually. Yeah. With Steve Dawson. Yeah. I recorded 2 or 3 songs with him, but he also came over to Alex's and put some harmonium on a couple songs. Yeah, Steve was really great to work with too. Like Steve Dawson, he was someone that I sent a few songs to. Like, is this even a song? Like, am I onto something? He's like, yeah, Nora, it's a song. You know, keep going.
Steve's like, very positive. He's a very good guy to have in your corner and also can play almost anything.
Yeah, he's great.
He has a really good sensibility. But how do you like memorize so many songs when you're doing so many different groups and I don't know. It just seems like you must have a very large repertoire of songs you have to play every year without like an iPad in front of you showing the lyrics.
Well, I do have lyrics in front of me. Like at any given gig, there's either a music stand. Well, it depends. It depends what it is. But like with the Flat Five, there's usually like one or two songs where it's either a song we just learned and I just don't quite know it yet, or I just need a lyric on the floor for safety, just in case. But I'm not sure. Yeah, I have thousands of songs in my head. It's just kind of part of the job. You learn a song and you memorize it. And, you know, there's little tricks like to memorizing, just trying to like get into the story and memorizing the song and or like just kind of associating chords with words. It's subconscious. I'm not exactly sure how it happens, but I'm not above having a sheet of paper on the stage at this point. No. Especially like, you know, I played a show with Robbie Foulkes on New Year's Eve and we did 30.
That was another one.
Songs.
Yeah. From 1974.
And while yes, those songs are in my DNA, like I needed to glance down at some lyrics every once in a while. I tried not to, but I really needed to.
Yeah. I was really regretting missing that one. That looked like a great show.
It was great.
And when you're writing, what's usually the starting point? Is it a phrase or is it a musical chord, like a chord change you come up with?
Usually,
or
I pick up my guitar, I start playing different chord progressions, and I kind of start la la la-ing and experimenting with melodies and vowel sounds, and then words start coming out, and you know, I just kind of start like stream of conscious, just like singing different words, and until like a little phrase or a story starts happening, and then I'll stop and write it down and start working on the lyrics a little more. But also for the last record, I tried like writing some stories and then turning it into a song. But I mostly start with guitar and melody.
So like the tarot card one, did you like have a and think, oh, that would be kind of a fun starting point for a song, was, you know, finding a tarot card in the backseat of the car?
Yeah.
You didn't actually find a tarot card in the backseat of the
car. I didn't. But, you know, I had my tarot cards read over COVID, over Zoom. And this woman who, like, didn't know me at all, like, she knew I was a musician, but she said, I think you need to write your own songs. Huh. And I was like, damn, okay. So that's kind of where that song jumped out of, because, you know, because I'm in all these different bands. I'm in like a lot of cover bands and I haven't written an album in 18 years. I was like, okay, you're right. You're right. I should. And I will.
And you didn't have like a backlog of like 18 years worth of songs that you'd sort of
I got a bunch aside. Of songs laying around, but I really just wanted to start fresh. Yeah. I'm not really good at kind of going back and editing. I just kind of keep plowing forward. Yeah.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for having me here and talking with me. This is really fun. Oh. I've been a fan for a long time. So getting beneath the music is a treat.
Thanks,
so.
Mark.
That's all for episode 166 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Nora O'Connor for inviting us into her home and her music world. Her latest album, My Heart, is available on CD and digitally from Chicago's Pravda Records. Pravda also released the second Flat 5 album, Another World, in 2020. The band's 2016 debut, It's a World of Hope and Love, is out on Bloodshot, as is O'Connor's 2004 solo album, Till the Dawn. If you have a chance to catch her live, do it. She's playing a Pravda Records showcase show at On Common Ground in Chicago on February 8th with Josh Caterer. The last of the Flat Five's Wig Out Wednesdays at the Hideout is February 5th with Paul Sebar. That show's sold out, but, you know, maybe you'll find a way. The Flat Five also will be playing at Stoughton Opera House near Madison, Wisconsin on February 22nd. And O'Connor, Kelly Hogan, and Seema Cunningham will be taking their Roses for the Roaches tribute show to Stoughton Opera House on April 5th. Tickets are still available for both shows. Look for O'Connor's upcoming solo living room gigs, too. She's got trips coming up to Arkansas, Texas, and Ohio. For more information, go to noraoconnormusic.com. and follow her on Instagram at Nora O'Connor King. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swaite, who also understands the magic of great harmonies. Thanks to Dave Drager for being a Carol Pop friend and supporting us at carolpop.com. If you'd like to throw something in the Carol Pop tip jar, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caro Pop on the socials. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro, at M-A-R-K-C-A-R-O. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Caro Pop conversation. Thanks.